Welcome to We Are Libertarians. With our triumphant return from break, we took December and I think half of November off to retool. Had a few changes. I actually left the Libertarian Party of Indiana. I was the executive director there, and I left to take a job in an advertising agency in Indianapolis. So we're now recording the podcast today from my apartment. Creighton is back, Creighton in all of his glory and knowledge. And if you are actually near a computer, you can go to our YouTube page, and you can check out this the video of it. We're going to start doing a little bit of expansion on the video. You can go to the chat section and text us a question, and we'll post that when we record a show. The biggest change, actually, is WeAreLibertarians.com. We put together a website. We added a couple more contributors besides myself, Creighton, and Chris, and we're expanding that a little bit. So we have written content as well as the podcast. One of our contributors is actually filling in for Chris Galt today. His name is Greg Linz. Greg, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris and Creighton.
Thank you. Chris Galt is, apparently he's working in snow removal, and I'd love to... Apparently he's working in snow removal, and we had several inches last night, so he's, who hasn't had, never mind. Chris, would you stop playing with your microphone?
This I can't help it, man.
It's a professional broadcast.
It's not at all.
So one of our live contributors is here, Greg Linz. Greg, welcome.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Greg and I went to high school together, Plainfield Fighting Quakers.
Damn right.
And he is our token conservative libertarian Republican type guy on the blog.
Yep.
He is a libertarian, but he generally supports and votes for Republicans, and we'll try to figure that out in a minute. Another contributor is Joe Ruiz. Joe ran for Congress in Congressional District 2, and Joe actually had his first post yesterday. We're recording this on Saturday, so go to WeAreLibertarians.com, check it out. We've built a Google Plus community. We've got a YouTube page where you'll see our live streams and other YouTube items. Maybe someday we'll produce some videos or something. But we're expanding We Are Libertarians a little bit, and we would appreciate your feedback. We'd love to hear topics that you'd like discussed on the show, topics that you'd like to see written about. So please get in touch with us. Our email, our fancy new shiny email, is editor. At WeAreLibertarians.com. So if you have any feedback on the show, on the blog, suggestions, or if you want to actually be a guest contributor, write something and send it to editor at WeAreLibertarians.com. So let's find out a little bit more about Greg, our contributor to We Are Libertarians. Greg, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, my name is Greg Linz. Like Chris said, we went to high school together. We actually went to church together growing up
Plainfield United Methodist.
Absolutely did.
I'm now fighting Methodists.
Yeah, I'm now a deist, so it did quite well and really did quite the number on me. But
Good old organized religion.
Exactly. I actually run an internet marketing company here in Indianapolis. I do online reverse mortgage leads and traditional refinance leads for different mortgage companies around the country. And I've always been interested in politics, and as far as my politics goes, I consider myself a Republican in practice, but a libertarian in theory. I haven't totally subscribed to the ideals of the Libertarian Party, but I definitely support the party. I'd like to see it, personally, like to see it get absorbed by the Republican Party and take the lead role in governing and creating legislation, and that's something I'd like to be a part of and help bring forth in the state of Indiana.
All right. Well, whenever Chris or Creighton can't be in, we're going to bring Greg and, you know, maybe Joe. Joe lives in South Bend, so we're in Greenwood right now. And if you know Indiana, that's a long way. So Joe couldn't be here today. This snow really messed everything up. We were actually going to have a photo shoot. And
I had
take
the
some,
perfect shirt.
I know. We're going to take...
I got a better one than the one I'm wearing.
Because we're trying to make the blog actually look presentable, which is why I don't know why we're putting our faces on it. So that kind of canceled it out. But whenever Chris or Creighton can't make it, we're going to ask Greg to come in and sit on the podcast. Or even when all three of us are here, we'll have him in sometime. So... thank you for writing on the blog, and thank you for being a part of the We Are Libertarians network.
Thank you. I enjoy it. It's great.
Yeah. So, which should we start with? Let's start chronologically, and let's start with gun control. After the Newton tragedies, obviously there, you know, has been a time of mourning, and there's always a productive time to have discussions about things like gun control. I personally don't believe that it's in the middle of a grieving process, and I think nationally there very much was a mourning. Gun rights advocates, or I don't know, gun control advocates, let's call them that, want to have the discussion right away because it's more emotional, and you can sway people who are on the fence to your side easier with that emotion. I always think those people look petty. Just like I think the gun rights advocates look petty when they try to say, well, if, you know, we had four hours after the tragedy, they're like, well, if the teachers were armed, it's like, dude, time and place. So we're past that now. We're a couple weeks away, and there's going to be a conversation about gun rights and gun control in this nation. So let's start with Creighton, and let's get your opinion on some of the discussion and just what do you think about the discussion that's going on right now with gun rights?
Petty is a good word for a lot of it, and disappointing to some extent on the people who I would tend to lean towards agreeing with. For example, the NRA guy saying that we need to have armed, like volunteer security funded by the government being in every school at all the time. I mean, stuff like that, that just like, that was a little beyond what I think was just practical. Just let people carry guns. I mean, it's let adults, you know, full-fledged sane adults that could protect kids carry guns. You don't have to have, you know, a separate entity come and be in part of every single school. But that's the NRA guy. And then on the gun right, the gun control side, you have, I mean, the only one that jumps out the most is Piers Morgan after all the hooting and hollering he did on his show the other day. I mean, those guys are just so beyond the pale of stubborn and insane that I can't even pretend to agree with them on any point. If anyone has seen the Piers Morgan show where they brought in, I don't remember the guy's name, if you know the guy's name, who talked about, he was the gun rights guy versus Piers Morgan, who's the gun control guy. And I mean, Piers Morgan spent about 5 minutes talking about gun control and the merits of it, and spent the rest of the time saying that you're an idiot, you're an absolutely stupid man, blah, 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 blah. I mean,
well, he has an exceptionally atrocious show.
I mean, yeah.
It really is pretty terrible.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, the long and short of it is really is just, I mean, I think everyone's heard it a million times. You take away guns. Ron Paul said it's a self-evident truth. Criminals do not obey laws. So making a law that says you can't have a gun means the people who obey the law, i.e. not criminals, will not have guns, and the criminals will. And that just shifts the balance of power in favor of the bad guys. I don't know. It seems pretty clear. Of course, you bring up statistics of how there's no guns in Europe, and they have such lower gun crime and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, I mean, their violent crime rates have risen since they've banned guns. Australia is a great example of that. They've banned guns in their entirety, and they started having tons more break-ins and violent crimes. Plus, they don't have the benefit of not being next to, you know, Mexico with their giant cartels, who would very easily get illegal guns into the United States if we banned them in their entirety. So, I don't know. It seems like an open and shut kind of argument. And the funny thing is that the same people that say we need to stop the drug war because prohibition of drugs doesn't work are the same people that say let's stop guns by making them illegal.
What are you going to do with 300 million already in the United States?
All right, there's a gun for every man, woman, and child in this country, and it's irrational for us to think that we can eliminate every single one of those.
And it's un-American, and I know I know that sounds like, you know, typical, you know, conservative right wing whatever.
But W.
the truth, yeah, the truth is that, I mean, it's more than just a gun rights argument. It's a property rights argument. I mean, it's property, and you can do harm to people with various forms of property, and guns are just ones that are very clear in their purpose, and that is to inflict damage. And a responsible gun owner inflicts damage against those that are trying to harm them. They use them for protection and defense. They can be abused. And a lot of property can be abused. But the truth is that America, we have a tradition of private property rights, and we have a tradition of specifically gun rights. I mean, that is really the truth. I mean, people will bring in the whole militia argument and all this junk, but the Second Amendment is probably the clearest amendment, the clearest phrasing in the Constitution as far as what the right of the individual is. The gun control advocates could at least grant that they're trying to propose something that is significantly un-American.
I mean, you really think that they give one crap about the Constitution?
I don't think for a minute they do, but at least have the dignity to admit that you're arguing from a perspective of, you know, something other than tradition, which is something that that I've noticed they try to use to their advantage. I mean, the Second Amendment had something to do with militia, so it's actually the American tradition is the militia needs arms. Well, we have a militia, it's the National Guard, so therefore people don't need guns. It's a stupid argument. I mean, it's very clear. It says right in the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. It doesn't say of the militia, it says of the people. It doesn't say the militia has the right, it says the people have the right. It's very clear. But for some reason, it's not clear enough to a large spectrum of Americans, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think Pierce Morgan displayed it perfectly when he mocked the Constitution as a flawed document.
Right.
And he mocked the Bible as a flawed document. I mean, he demonstrates what he is right there.
How many people have signed the thing to get him deported?
I don't want to sign up for the White House's website. You have to actually register to the website to sign it, so I don't want to do that.
I think we had this conversation before. You're signing up on the whitehouse.gov website to let them know that you're in favor of secession.
Yep.
I mean, I may already be on a watch list, but I don't want to move up two notches, you know?
Yeah. Plus, there's that beautiful graphic of Robert E. Lee on the horseback. Let's go to whitehouse.gov and sign a petition.
We're seceding. So, guns. Guns, what are some of you, Greg, what's some of your thoughts on gun rights?
My thoughts are similar to Creighton's. I do think there is a discussion that needs to happen. After the Newton thing, obviously what happened was like what Rahm Emanuel said after the financial crisis, never let a good crisis go to waste. They seized on it. They want to get something passed. They've got the sentiment on their side right now. I believe, I haven't looked at the most recent polling data, but it seems like it's tipped in that direction. And I think there are probably merits to not have AR-15s on the street or have them more highly regulated. Now, handguns, things like that for self-defense, I'm completely fine with. I don't have any issue with it at all. I myself, as a gun owner, I don't own an AR-15. I think if I would, I would probably only shoot it with my redneck friends back in Plainfield, blowing up cars, things like that. But I can't see the argument of why it's necessary. And I know that's not the heart of the argument, but I don't see a huge downside to outlawing or making it more difficult to get an AR-15. And Newton's a bad example because that was bought legally, if I'm right. Mm-hmm. The mom bought that legally. That's something there's probably no way to prevent.
And from what I understand, is the main crux of what they're trying to do now is just reinstitute the federal firearms ban that they had back in the 90s. And from what I understand, Connecticut had that as a ban, that had
they
that do. Language as state law. So right then and there, you're kind of faced with the prospect of, well, this was state law in the state it happened, but it still happened. I don't think for a minute that the gun control advocates are coming from a perspective of this will, I don't know. I think it's more of an issue that they've, I mean, everyone knows they've had it for years. I mean,
it's a vanity thing.
Yeah. The 90s, they've had it. I mean, ever since Columbine, even before that, even back to an extent back to when Reagan had the attempted assassination, there has been this push to have government do something about guns to literally no success. I mean, for every legislation they've passed, there's been no success. There hasn't been a huge dismantling of gun control laws in America. The federal firearms ban just expired.
Yeah, last.
So there, it's not like there's been this huge push to remove a ton of restrictions, and that's how the numbers have been going up. If anything, more laws have been passed, you know, in states to ban guns. In Chicago, I know they had Jesse Jackson on yesterday to basically explain why in Chicago, with its basically Nazi control of guns, they had 500th homicide with guns.
If you want to see what he said and watch the video of what he said, go to wearelibertarians.com, and on the sidebar, it says Google Communities. We've got a Google community that you can join, and someone posted the video of what Jesse Jackson said. It's just like your mind hurts after you read it because it makes so little sense.
And that's a great way to put it. It's a vanity thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the greatest sin is vanity. Americans have this culture of when something bad happens, they ought to make a law. It's like it's a knee-jerk reaction. They ought to make a law. And I feel like the left is jumping on that, full-fledged jumping on that, saying, well, let's make a law.
Oh, they've been waiting for this forever.
Oh, yeah. And that's the sad thing, is that they have waited. They have been, you know, they have been waiting for a tragedy. After Virginia Tech, you heard it. After Columbine, it happened after Columbine. But
it feels, there was several interesting articles that I read. I mean, it feels like this is happening more and more. It feels like it's becoming more and more common. But something really interesting has happened since the Great Recession. Crime rates have gone down.
Yeah.
Mass murders have gone down. Gun violence has gone down. I think theft is even down.
Yeah, like all crimes are down
30%. All crimes are down. And it's really sort of counterintuitive, because whenever we've had a recession, crime goes up normally. What we're seeing, though, is sort of an echo chamber. Because the world is so much smaller, we feel like this is happening more and more, even though it's not. It's there was an article that I will share on the show notes on WeAreLibertarians.com, where they talk about the biggest school massacre in American history. And it was sometime in the 20s, and it was up in Michigan, and this guy blew up a schoolhouse and killed 36 kids and all the adults that were in the schoolhouse. Well, it never happened. I don't think there was another school massacre, shooting, or anything until the 90s, the early 90s. And so what has happened is there's an echo chamber, and it feels like it's happening more. It feels like it overwhelms us. You know, one of the things that I think we can do to solve the problem is go after news organizations, write letters to editors and managers, news directors, and say, please stop mentioning this person's name on the air. These people are not heroes. Anderson Cooper and CNN, but specifically Cooper, made the decision that we're not going to talk about his name. We're going to mention his name when it is absolutely necessary, but we may say it one time on this hour, and that's it. Because I'm never going to make someone famous for murder, for something where they violate someone else's rights. And I thought that was an important step to ending some of this. I think there is a large aspect that, you know, when you look at someone who is a serial killer, and these guys are serial killers just in a short burst of time, they're very ego-driven. It is about stroking their ego. From a psychological standpoint, it is the fact that they will be well-known. And the less well-known we can make these scumbags, the better off we're going to be. I think that's an important first step.
Yeah, and I think Penn Jillette, I saw him, I don't remember where he was on, but
Wendy Williams.
Was it Wendy Williams?
Yeah, he was great.
He straight up said, yeah, he said, he made an excellent point. He's like, this is a terrible tragedy, but it's also an anomaly. I mean, math is on the side of people who want guns for sane reasons, for protection and sport and hunting. I mean, it's so statistically insignificant. While it is tragic when it happens, the statistics of when they happen is so insignificant that, I mean, you would be considered insane if you tried to say that that was the definition of the class. I mean, to extrapolate this one event as the whole class of gun owners is what they're trying to do, but it's just people would, you know, laugh in your face. It's just, it's ridiculous. And he made that point. It's a great point. I mean, it is an anomaly. Most people who own guns are just average Joes. They don't want to kill anybody.
I loved how he talked about, if you want to get serious, swimming pools and seatbelts kill children by a magnitude of 10 over gun violence. And of course, they didn't want to hear that.
Yeah. And it's ridiculous. I mean, and then of course, he also, there has been a slight trend to try and blame Asperger's. For this.
Vilify people with Asperger's.
Especially coming from people who are, the left tend to be, from what I have gathered in my life, they tend to be more, they emphasize political correctness to a larger extent than I would say other groups of people. I use all those terms lightly. A lot of them have been saying that, you know, Asperger's, and then he's sitting at home playing Call of Duty and he has Asperger's, and then he goes out and he kills a bunch of people. And it's like, Asperger's just kind of makes you put your foot in your mouth.
Yeah.
Is really kind of what it does. That's really the extent of it. It's not like schizophrenia. You just kind of put your foot in your mouth and That's really about it. But they're out there trying to say that Call of Duty and Asperger's caused this guy to kill 27 kids. I mean, no. That's not what it was.
I mean, how many people with Asperger's committed crimes last year? I'm sure it's nothing.
Yeah. I mean, I know someone with Asperger's. I mean, they just kind of put their foot in their mouth. That's about the extent of it.
Yeah.
And they're completely sane. They completely understand right and wrong. It's kind of interesting to see how both sides have reacted to this. Like I said, the NRA's reaction was just ridiculously dumb. I couldn't believe that they went that route. But
yeah.
Americans have tended to lean on the side of, you know, gun freedom rather than gun control. It's not to say that they don't support gun control, but for the most part, you know, total gun prohibition isn't necessarily what traditionally America has stood for. And I think after all the hubbub has died down over this, that's kind of where it'll go back to. Plus, I don't think they're going to get anything passed in Congress.
No way.
I don't think it's going to happen. No. So
I don't know. You know, the problem for Congress, you know, for the Democrats especially, is if there's 8 senators who are in states that are pro-gun, and they're Democrats who have ran on pro-gun platforms, and if they vote for it, then they are
exposed.
The Republicans will be plus one. You know, it's so I don't know if it'll happen or not. It's, you know, if you're a Democrat, you're looking at it and saying, "Will these Democrats have spines?" And I just don't think you can get 8 politicians with spines.
No.
So,
well, I'm not worried about the Senate. I don't think the House is where. Yeah, right. The House is never going to go through the House, is what I'm talking about. But
Vayner doesn't even let like undersecretaries come up for nomination.
Yeah, that's assuming the House doesn't implode on itself in the near future.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if that happened too. But yeah, it'll be an interesting few weeks to see how this kind of plays out. But of course, as far as Washington concerned, everything's taking a back seat to the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, I think there's one thing that really can't go unmentioned here, and it is mental health. It's access to mental health. It's incredibly important, and, you know, I know it's so cliche to talk about guns don't kill people, people kill people. You know, you're not going to charge a hammer for murder, there is definitely an aspect to that. But these people who do this are significantly deranged, and there are signs in their lives without fail. And I think I saw this on 60 Minutes. Their profiler, who works with the FBI on kids who become mass murderers like this, without fail, at some point leading up to the tragedy, they tell someone in their life that they are going to commit this kind of act. And no one in the family does anything about it. There was a great article that everybody should look up. It's called I Am Adam Lanza's Mother. And it was a powerful account of a mom who is struggling with a son who is basically a psychopath. And she has gone to local hospitals. She has gone to mental health charities in the area. She has gone to government agencies. And there is absolutely nobody who can help her with her son's emotional and behavioral and psychological issues. And there may be somebody out there, but there's no easy path for them to connect with a professional. And that's scary. That's something that, you know, Obama talks about how the politics of gun control are too hard. Well, they are. Well, let's do something where it isn't hard. It isn't hard to say we as a society should have an open dialogue about mental health. We shouldn't put a stigma on people who have mental health issues. We shouldn't block access to healthcare. Insurance agencies, even government agencies, can open up avenues that can make it more accessible and easier for people to get the care that they need. And that is a significant problem in our society today that hurts far more people than guns do, honestly. And I don't think there's a family that isn't affected by some form of mental health issues. I mean, I'm not advocating for more laws or more public funding for this or that. It should be the conversation, because that is not too hard. That is not a difficult political issue to look at what government regulations are blocking or what are we putting on insurance companies that cause us to give bad care. So that, to me, stands out as the most important thing here.
I think that's the heart of that argument is the exact same as the war on drugs. Is that I read that Adam Lanza's mother article, and she the advice she got was have her son commit a crime so he could be put away and then receive the care in jail. And it's the same with the war on drugs. You commit a crime, we don't spend money on rehabilitation. We spend money on putting and imprisoning our population. And I think that's the kind of mindset we have to get over in the discussion we have to have, one towards rehabilitation, one where it's not black and white, where there is a big gray area, and we can work towards that to a solution of helping people with mental health issues and at the same time helping people who have drug abuse problems.
Right. All right, so anything else on the gun control, gun rights discussion that we've left out that we ought to mention? All right, so let's talk about the fiscal cliff. First, let's let's first talk about what the fiscal cliff is. And Creighton is our smart person. He is the one who usually knows everything. So we're going to ask him, what is the fiscal cliff?
It is a terrible metaphor. To tell you the truth, it is simply back when they had the debt ceiling debate, the last time they had it, they were trying to come up to an agreement between the committee of the gang of six or whatever they called it, gang of five, or it changes every time. But they basically had a mechanism in place where if they didn't come to an agreement, then the worst of both worlds would come for both sides, essentially trying to make it so that this would happen and they would have to do something whenever it came to that point. And what happens is there's a large amount of tax increases and a large amount of spending cuts. And I asterisk both of those for a second. But a large amount of spending cuts and tax increases that are set to go in effect on January 1st if nothing is resolved and they just let things go as they are. And right, what's going on is Obama and the Democrats are debating over with Boehner and the Republicans over, you know, what is going to be the replacement for the fiscal cliff. You know, what's going to get cut? Obama, of course, is saying that we need to raise taxes some. The whole balanced approach thing he's been pushing for, you know, 2 years now. And then Boehner is saying we don't need to raise taxes. And then everybody was trying to say Grover Norquist was the ruler of the world. And, you know, it's just been excellent political theater for, you know, a few months now. And to tell you the truth, I don't think they're going to do anything. Today might be the day we find out if they do anything, but I would not be one little bit surprised if nothing happens and everything goes the way it went. It's going to go. But when I say I asterisk those phrases, I've been kind of clear on at least as on Twitter that these are not spending cuts, nor are they tax increases. And it's important to understand what Washington speak is. It's all cuts and increases from baseline budgeting, which what that means is, and I'm going to drop Rush Limbaugh argument here, and he actually very clearly puts it out, and he says, let's say that you right now decide that tomorrow you are going to spend at least, or you're going to spend $50,000 on a car. You budget yourself $50,000 you're going to spend on a car. And then let's say you go out and you start looking for a car and you find one that is perfect for $40,000 and you decide to buy it for $40,000 and you tell yourself, I just saved $10,000. I cut my spending by $10,000 because I found a $40,000 car. Well, no, you increased your spending by $40,000. You just didn't increase it as much as you thought you were going to. And that's exactly what they're doing in Washington. They were going to increase spending this much, but they decided that they're going to increase it less than that. It's still getting increased, just not as much. And they're calling that difference a cut. And the same thing with the tax increases. They're saying that if the taxes don't change, then you have a tax increase because we could cut them. Or something like that. It's doublespeak is what it is. It's just accounting gimmicks. And that's what they're saying. So these $400 billion spending cuts from defense are $400 billion decrease in the amount of increase is what it is. It's still going to go up. The absolute amount of dollars going out of Washington into the defense industry will be more next year than it will be this year. It just won't be as much more. And it's important to remember that, because they're trying to say that, you know, these $400 billion are going to cripple the defense industry and that soldiers won't get paid and defense contract. I actually heard on the an argument yesterday. I just wanted to just throw economics in one lesson at the TV. It was a guy on TV saying that if we cut spending because of the sequestration, then all of these defense industries will get so much money sent. It'll be cut from, they won't get as much money coming in, and they'll have to lay off workers. And that's going to decrease jobs, and that's bad for the economy. I mean, it's just like, it screams of the broken window fallacy. But I mean, that's what's going on right now. They're basically just bickering over whether or not they're going to increase spending by this much or increase it by a little bit less than that. And that's what they're fighting over. So don't believe for a second that they're talking about cutting spending.
By the way, Chris Galt has joined us on the text machine here in the Google Hangout, and we're now watching his screen. I don't know how, but it's basically him browsing Reddit. So, don't go to Gone Wild, by the way, Galt. So, Greg, what do you think about the fiscal cliff?
I think in the long run, it's probably a good thing. I think it's a great solution. I think we're also going to see quite a bit of inflation going forward once we get out of this economic mess. I know Paul Krugman writes about the ISLM model right now.
And
When you're in a liquidity trap, interest rates are low. Right now, we don't really know. We know interest rates are low because everyone else is nervous around the rest of the globe, so they flood our treasury market, and the Fed buys the treasury bills as well. So we don't know, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but ultimately, I think we're going to have this. We're going to have the fiscal cliff. We're going to slightly raise the inflation target in the long run, and I don't think it'll actually hurt anyone too badly. It's a lot of political theater, like Creighton was saying, but I actually think it's a decent solution. It's not ideal, but for our budget deficit and trying not to hurt the economy, I don't think it'll have a huge effect.
I look at it, and I think, you know, I don't know if they said this out loud, but maybe they gave each other a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and said, all these tax increases and all of these budget cuts are necessary to help end our deficit or to get the deficit down, and we don't want to have to put our name on a vote and go back to our district and say that we raised taxes this much or cut the budget this much. So let's devise this fiscal cliff where we get these necessary measures and we don't have to put our names on it, and we get to blame the other guy. Brilliant.
Well, I think Obama and the Democrats are doing a much better job of blaming the other guy than the Republicans are, and I think I think that's why everybody's saying get rid of Boehner, is because this really should have been a home run. It's just a deficit reduction issue, and the Republican Party has been all about deficit reduction since, you know, 2010. For sure, that's one of the reasons they got elected, was because of they wanted the new class to get tough on the deficit. And they just completely botched it, and now Obama's making them look like they don't care about the deficit because they don't want to touch taxes.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is anyone with a half a brain knows that you could increase taxes on the top 10% for 100% of their worth, and we wouldn't run the government for a year. I mean, taxes are not the issue. There's literally there's no possible way you could tax your way into balancing the budget. It's just impossible.
Because the deal he offered raised taxes for the top tax bracket.
It's just the Bush tax cuts.
And it raised like $60 billion a year, which is like, what, 15 to 20 days to run the federal government?
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. It's like one aircraft carrier a week or something. I mean, it's like, it's just totally ridiculous that this is, but he's selling the American public on saying, oh, well, they don't care because they don't want to touch taxes. And everybody, oh, the taxes, and we need the taxes and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. There is the real problem is, and this is the bad thing, is everybody's worried about this fiscal cliff. The real problem is that the unfunded liabilities, present value of unfunded liabilities for Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid over the next, I think, 30 years is something like $200 trillion.
Yeah.
That is like more than the world GDP.
If we started printing money now, we still wouldn't be able to pay that.
They don't make machines that can print money fast enough to cover all that. I mean, that is the real problem. And there has been no attempt to address that. I mean, Robert Murphy thinks that next year, Robert Murphy is an Austrian economist. He works out of the Mises Institute, and he's a senior economist at the, I think, the Institute for Energy Research. but he's really, really sharp guy. He thinks that the Fed is going to monetize next year the equivalent of our deficit. He specifically tried to make clear that he doesn't think they're going to monetize the deficit, but they're going to monetize enough to be equivalent to the deficit.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. Oh. And it's just, they're running out of options. Either interest rates are going to shoot up and, you know, the other recession that's looming around the corner is going to hit, or the inflation's going to shoot up, and you know we're going to have. I don't think that you're going to be able to. I mean, back when inflation shot up in the 70s, they had to raise interest rates, and one of those things is going to happen in the near future. And
what was that noise? Was that Mittens?
Yeah, he's up on the fridge.
Mittens. All right, let me ask this question because I'm conflicted. All right, at my core, I'm an anarcho-capitalist, but I also look. I've always have been.
Oh.
I just am also a pragmatist. I look at, you
no,
know,
I got you.
I've been raised on the teat of Abdul Hakim Shabazz, and I look at everything pragmatically. What is possible right now? An ANCAP society would be my preferred society, but I mean, how? We're like 6% of the voting population, so we have to work within a certain reality. What?
Seasteading.
What?
Nothing. Yep.
Peter Thiel.
Yeah. That's our... We need to just build a rapture underwater.
That's Milton Friedman's grandson that's heading that, isn't it?
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, I think he is.
I know his... I don't know.
So, here's the problem that we face. We have this deficit, and we have a spending problem, and we have to make cuts. Are we as libertarians willing, if we were in Congress, if we were Rand Paul, if we were Justin Amash, would you vote for tax increases? What would you personally do?
If I was the one signing that, you know, pushing that button, I would not vote for tax increases unless there were more spending cuts at the moment I put. The same vote that increased taxes is the same vote that would decrease spending by more than tax increases.
Right.
And that's the only way I could ever see any possible way of making that a compromise in the right direction. And I say that, I mean, you got to be careful because last time they said, well, give us tax increases now and we'll give you spending cuts in the future. So they said, well, this is a vote for spending cuts. But anytime they say that, spending cuts never come. I mean,
right.
Well, you said it's not a cut. It's just a
less yeah, increase. Of course. And it has to be an actual spending cut. It can't just be a cut in increases.
And it has to be a cut in increases, and it has to be effective almost immediately. It can't be next fiscal budget year. We promise.
Yeah, I would say. Why can't it be? Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe because Boehner's just a poor speaker. It's like, why can't it be spending cuts now, tax cuts in the future? I mean, they're trying to push the tax cuts or tax increases now, spending cuts in the future. Why can't we just do spending cuts now, tax increases in the future? Flip it around. Do the spending cuts first and say, we'll give you tax increases in the future. I mean...
You going to go for that, though, if you're a Democrat?
Of course.
Right.
That's the thing. But they're trying to make it seem like that isn't an option. I mean, they have made it seem like that is not an option. And I guess I got to give it to them for good politics because it is an option.
So the question is, if I'm a libertarian and I'm in Congress right now and want to work a deal, would I take this deal? That's the...
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or some deal. What would be your deal that would make you vote for tax increases?
I mean, ideally, like Creighton said, you know, you would love to say, hey, we're going to cut spending now, we're going to raise taxes in the future. I don't know that you actually have to do that. I think you... Mittens likes Creighton, doesn't
Mittens
you?
Mittens is a Creighton fan.
Apparently. Yeah, you could probably work something like that. I think I would let the president win on the top income earners. I would say, you know what, we're going to give you the 39.6 high income rate for people over $500,000 a year. You can have that. We'll keep the taxes the same for everybody else. But in exchange, you got to say give us, as a token, $100 billion less in spending this year. Part of that, or we can even say a majority of that can be military. And it doesn't have to be a true cut. It can be a cut on future increases. Because I think that's what's really going to... Like, once the economy comes back, our deficits are going to shrink quite a bit. I mean, our growth is what, right now, about 1.7 to 2.2 GDP growth a year. If we can get that back up around 4.4%, our deficits aren't going to be a big deal going forward, in my opinion. I really don't see it being a huge issue. The real problems are the entitlements long term.
That, yeah.
And they're not even talking about those.
Yeah, but the big thing that I'm afraid of is I don't necessarily see that we are on the brink of a recovery. I think, I mean, the Great Depression was two different recessions. I think we're in the interim between another recession. And I think that they are setting the fundamentals have been set that it's just a ticking time bomb. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, it's just like the stuff we know of is like $16 trillion of new money they just made out of thin air to give to other banks, to give to our banks, to give to the government. And that's just what we know of, and that's a partial audit. I mean, it's just there is no way that you can just print that much money, that you can just spend so much, and you can manipulate interest rates so much. I mean, it wreaks havoc on the capital structure. And I think what we've done is we've just injected the heroin addict with more heroin, and he's feeling nice right now, but he's going to come crashing down. And I don't necessarily see as... I think that this fiscal cliff, or maybe bad Christmas sales, or something next. This, I mean, if you've seen the numbers, the student loan bubble.
That's the next bubble.
Student loan bubble looks like it's about to burst. I mean, next year could be a bad year. Yeah. It could be a really bad year for the economy. Like another recession, bad recession.
I think you've said it before that if the retailers don't have a good Christmas, that could be incredibly bad. You combine these crippling tax increases without a real significant actual cut in what we're spending. You combine that with bad Christmas numbers. You combine that with student loan debt crumbling. I mean, it spells trouble. I mean, and also trouble in the Eurozone as well. So, to answer the question myself, you have to give and take. I mean, there's no way around it. You have to give and take in this situation. You have to vote for some tax increases, but only if it's for actual spending cuts. And I know that, you know, some of these Tea Party guys, some of these libertarian-leaning Republican guys, they take a tremendous amount of heat for saying what we just said. And they're completely blamed for this entire mess, despite the fact that Boehner gets his caucus in line, he puts together a plan that they're all mostly willing to accept, at least enough to get it passed, to get the votes. And then the Obama and the Democrats, they blow it. They say, we're not accepting this. This is not enough. We want more. You know, and it's like, okay, then it's on you. But somehow it always gets blamed on, you know, the fiscal conservatives. It blows my mind, but it goes back to what we were talking about before with, you know, the CNN's coverage of the Newton tragedy. You look at Soledad O'Brien and some of those folks, it's like, you know, so Mr. Gun Control Advocate, how are we as a society going to pass enough laws to get rid of these guns and get them off the street? Like, that is not a fair and balanced question. That's not, you know, that's the fiscal cliff issue is, you know, what is wrong with the Tea Party Republicans and all these guys? So, I don't know. Are we screwed?
I think we're screwed, tell you the truth. God's honest truth, I think we're screwed. I in the sense of, if you mean by screwed mean the economy is going to be destroyed, I think that's going to happen. I honestly don't see enough spine in Washington for them to get anything done of note. Honestly, I think that the economy is going to tank next year or the year after. I think it's just going to implode.
I'm not sure. Like, I was pretty much along the lines of economic thinking at Creighton for a long time. But as I've looked at this, like, it's not a recession because we've had growth. It's more like a zombie economy that's just kind of limping along. But a lot of the Keynesian ideas have been proven pretty true in this. I mean, over the last few years...
Oh, Creighton's about to beat the
hell out of you. But I'm saying right now, we've spent like crazy. We've tripled the money supply. Bernanke's tripled the money supply. And interest rates are at all-time lows. Now, if the economy ever gets on solid footing and starts growing again, we're going to see interest rates go up. But right now, like, everyone's been predicting inflation for, what, 4 years since 2008? Or before, since 2007? And we're seeing some, but we're not seeing at the levels that we've increased the money supply at.
Well, it's hard to get inflation when banks sit on money and don't make loans.
Exactly. That's true. They aren't lending like they should be. But, well, I mean, they're still lending pretty well. The banks are doing relatively well. And I don't think the M2 money supply hasn't contracted that low, has it? It's picked up quite a bit.
Oh, God. What are the cats doing in there?
I don't know the specific numbers on how much it's contracted. I don't think it's contracted at all, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
My judgment is basically from a fundamental perspective. I mean, the amount of, you know, new credit that has just flooded the market, and it's not necessarily flooded into the people that actually use it. It's flooded into the distributors. And I mean, it's going to take time for that to go out, but when it does, it's going to fundamentally misdirect the problem I have with the Keynesian analysis is looking at things from an aggregate perspective, it misunderstands that capital isn't just a blob. It is intricately woven throughout people. It has a purpose. It's dictated by time preferences. I mean, there's just so many intricate things. It's like any other price system. They're all interchanged and interwoven, and it is a market. Looking at it from the aggregate just makes it look like, well, if we just increase, you know, aggregate demand and we spend this much money, then it'll be fine. And when the economy starts kicking off and the motor goes into overdrive, then we can start paying off the deficit then. And I mean, I don't think that's ever happened.
That's not a politically workable economics. Like, that's always been my critique of Keynesianism. Well, no one ever wants to raise taxes when the economy's doing well. So you end up just spending and having.
Well, I don't even think the argument is that you would have to increase taxes. I think the argument is that when the economy's growing, you get more revenue coming in.
True.
So the argument is that you just stimulate the economy, and when it starts kicking off and the motor goes into overdrive, more money comes in just by default, just by percentages being bigger when the absolute blob's bigger. Yeah. But I don't think that's ever happened. I don't think that the last time they ever tried to say that is how it worked was that when World War II happened. And honestly, the economy didn't really start healing until after World War II when they started deregulating and stopped spending so much.
But like what Bernanke did, you would argue, would be a pretty Keynesian idea to increase the money supply that much. We just haven't had the fiscal side from Congress to buy into that.
Well, I would say yes. Bernanke does mark me as a very tried and true Keynesian, but he also marks me as a guy who lived in a time, you know, saw what happened in the 70s when, you know, the kinds of the Keynesian just in increase in inflate and unemployment will take care of itself. That kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
So he also is trying to deal with that to an extent. So he doesn't want inflation to go crazy, but at the same time, he wants interest rates to stay low. But have interest rates stay low, you have to increase the money supply through banks. And then, but they're doing that can increase inflation. And at the same time, you also have to remember, and this is something that I think Murray Rothbard did excellent work explaining during the Great Depression, is just because the CPI or the GDP whatever it's called, the
global pricing,
the GDP
nominal,
it's the inflation indicator that they use with the GDP. I don't remember, but the CPI or the GDP inflation indicator, I think it's like the derivative or something, I don't remember what it's called, forgive me,
dumbass.
Yes. I don't remember the exact term. But either way, those numbers are all based upon nominal adjusted increases in prices. But that misunderstands what prices are. Prices are, you know, ratios of essentially utility that people have for good. So if, for example, during the Great Depression, prices didn't really go up a lot. Or during the 20s, I mean. During the 20s, the prices did not increase dramatically. But they should have been decreasing. So the fact that they didn't change means that, you know, you had this credit misallocation occurring. And that's what, at least Rothbard argued, caused the Great Depression, was keeping prices stable printing credit to keep prices stable caused the misallocation that ended up being the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing can be happening here. And I'm not going to go on the record and say that's what's happening. But just because the CPI isn't going up doesn't mean that you're not having the problem. Inflation itself, per se, is not necessarily a problem. Because even in a healthy economy, free market, let's say no government at all economy, you can have inflation.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily hurt everything. What it is if inflation is a result of credit expansion just willy-nilly given into the market through loaners, through banks. That's when you get credit misallocation that increases capital structure at the expense of. I mean, you got to get into whole economic capital theory here, but nevertheless, you can have that and not have like CPI indicators going up.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that inflation is terrible or that inflation isn't here. It just means that it isn't showing up in the standard indicators because they only try and do, you know, nominal adjusted increases in prices. I mean, So, I mean, there's a bajillion things. So that's why I just say, just look at the fundamentals. You have the Fed printing $16 trillion that we know of, and that's going out into the market. It may not be out into people's hands that actually start businesses or build buildings or actually use it, because the banks are sitting on it. But once they do, people are going to start spending it, and then you're going to start seeing prices increase to an extent, unless interest rates kick up.
And they will.
They might.
And eventually they're going to have to. I mean, the banks
they will
the
have.
Seniors are getting screwed right now, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they will have to if Bernanke doesn't. If Bernanke goes the route of saying that he doesn't want, you know, 1970-style inflation to happen again, he doesn't want stagflation to an extent, then I think you'll see a more extended period of lower interest rates, because Ben Bernanke is going that route. But the fact is, I don't think Ben Bernanke is that kind of person. So it could be that he just says, screw, we'll keep interest rates low, and we'll print money out the wazoo. And that's all he worries about. He's on record saying he'd just throw helicopter money out of a helicopter to keep interest rates low. Mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of person. I don't think he has the spine to let interest rates rise when they need to. And I think, just from a perspective that I've experienced, just seeing how he acts and what he's written, I think he'll just print money because that's all he knows how to do. And his thesis is, I mean, his whole career is based on the thesis that the Great Depression could have been avoided had they just printed more money.
Yeah, because it was deflation that caused, you know,
that's
deflation.
His whole career.
That's where you get political consequences. So, like, let's say we do that recession and Bernanke's not in the Fed chair position.
Oh, he is retiring.
Yeah, he is retiring.
So, there's that.
I don't know who they're talking about. I heard John Taylor's name being kicked around, but...
You know what? I bet it's Geithner.
No way.
Fed. Now.
No way.
Would you be surprised?
No.
Yeah, probably not. But deflation has huge political consequences. You know, you start having prices drop. Now, granted, there's a sharp recession, but then you get massive layoffs. You get all that pain. And so, really, from a political perspective, Keynesianism is the idea.
Well, that's why it became so popular.
Yeah.
It's because he basically just came along and say, hey, all that stuff you wanted to do, I'll make it official.
Yeah.
I'll put an economic theory around it. I mean, people had known for, you know, since before Adam Smith, that unemployment did not cause, you know, basic economic theory to collapse on itself, and you had to have a general theory.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knew that unemployment was just a result of price changes.
Yeah.
I mean, wages are a price. Unemployment is a result of, you know, to a large extent, they just said it was basically you keep wages sticky through minimum wage laws, you keep them sticky through union wage laws, then you're going to cause unemployment that's involuntary. But he came along and he said, you know what? I'm going to make this nice and fancy. I'm going to throw a bunch of simple. I'm going to throw a bunch of graphs in there. I'm going to bring up some new concepts. And I mean, some of his stuff's just been abandoned, like the labor time. He tried to make a new number. I don't remember what it was called, like time labor indicator or something, is like wage hours or some number that was like some aggregate. They tried to basically quantify something that you couldn't. I don't remember exactly. It's been a while since I've read it. But
it was a target for them to shoot for.
Yeah, it was just like number. He tried to create like a wage unit, kind of like Marx did.
Yeah.
And just they've abandoned that since then. But it's just, he came along and he basically told the politicians, do what you want to do. I'll make it look nice. And they ate it up.
Yeah.
And it's just really, it's just mercantilism is all it is. It's just old school mercantilism that took a new form and became fancy.
Well, we're almost out of time, so let's finish up with our final thoughts. Let's start with Greg. What final thoughts would you like to share with the audience this week?
I think pay close attention this week to the fiscal cliff. What you're going to see is traditional. You're going to see the Democrats making the Republicans look like people who don't care about anybody. They want to kick kids out of school. They want fewer teachers. They want old people to be pushed over a cliff. But really make sure you pay attention. Creighton gave great advice today talking about the baseline budgeting. Keep that in mind. Me personally, I don't think it's going to be a big deal. I think you're going to see an overreaction in the stock market early next week. After that, I think things will level off. I don't think it's going to end up being as big a deal. I think we'll end up seeing probably 2.5%, 3% inflation for an extended period of time. I don't think we'll see any meaningful cuts, real cut, true cuts, going forward. And I really don't see any major changes coming to America's political system in we'll just continue running deficits, and as the economy improves, we'll just see smaller and smaller deficits for an extended period of time.
I have two final thoughts. The first is that Greg has he uncannily sounds like Peyton Manning. His voice is very similar to Peyton Manning. And the second is we failed to mention, and we would be totally remiss if we didn't mention this. In the 30 minutes we talked about gun control, we didn't explain what the Second Amendment truly means. The Second Amendment.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
How could we forget this?
The Second Amendment was designed to protect us from a tyrannical government.
Yes.
It wasn't built for sport. It wasn't built for hunting. The Second Amendment was built to protect us from... it was to protect our life, our liberty, and our property.
It was the last line of defense of the Constitution.
Right. And so when someone tries to hurt you and hurt your life, your liberty, or your property, then you should have the right to defend yourself.
Even if that person who's trying to hurt you is the government.
Is the government. And I'm not saying that the government is tyrannical. I know that there are people who think that the government is tyrannical, but if you've lived under a tyrannical regime, we're not there yet.
we're not Africa and
right.
all those places yet.
Based on the fact that we can have this podcast and no one from the government gives a crap, we're not a tyrannical
government. But wait until we get more listeners.
Wait until we get to...
Our time will come.
Right now, we're only at tens and tens of listeners. So... So we may get there, we may not get there, but we sure as heck will get there a lot slower if we have a well-armed society. And a well-armed society is also a society that takes guns seriously, that doesn't look at them as play objects, that aren't, fantasized about and romanticized by movies. You know, there is a tremendous amount of violence in our culture, and that is not part of being a responsible gun owner. It is violence is the antithesis of the libertarian philosophy. Every member of the Libertarian Party, when you sign up, you take the Libertarian Pledge, and you pledge to not initiate any force against anyone else's rights, that you will swear to not harm anyone else's life, liberty, or property. And that is what libertarians believe, that you keep to yourself. Now, does this mean that you can own a nuclear weapon? In my opinion, no. I don't think you can own a nuclear weapon, even if the government has a nuclear weapon. And heck, I don't think the government should have nuclear weapons. And the reason is that it's very easy to destroy other people's life, liberty, and property with those sorts of weapons. Heck, you two may disagree. You may have one in your basement already. But so that is what the true meaning of the Second Amendment is. It's meant to help you protect your life, liberty, and property.
Yeah.
So, final thoughts for the week, Creighton?
Happy New Year.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you for joining us on this week of We Are Libertarians. Make sure you go check out the new WeAreLibertarians.com, where Greg writes a great daily briefing about interesting links, and we're going to do a little more as we get some more time to expand some of that to... hopefully even put out a daily or weekly or monthly or all three newsletter in your inbox. I know.
I gotta get on that.
You gotta get more disciplined. Me too.
I know.
So there's content up there every day in addition to the weekly podcast. Please go check it out. Share it with your friends. The only way that this grows and gets better is if you help us grow it. So please go to iTunes, click on the podcast, rate it, comment it. Share the episode with your friends on Facebook, Twitter, even Google+. And we thank you for listening to We Are Libertarians. We'll see you next week. Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell. This podcast is produced by What Is a Hoosier Productions.
I can join on the Hangout. People can watch me talk too.
Oh, cool. What kind of phone do you have?
BlackBerry.
I did.
You know what's funny is I love it.
Oh, BlackBerry.
It's got a keyboard.
That's so cute.